and the mud of the earth. He would like himself to be as necessary as pure idea, as one, all, absolute spirit, and he finds himself enclosed in a limited body, in a place and time he did not choose, to which he was not called, useless, awkward, absurd. His very being is carnal contingence, to which he is subjected in his isolation, in his unjustifiable gratuitousness. It also dooms him to death. This quivering gelatin that forms in the womb, secret and sealed like a tomb, is too reminiscent of the soft viscosity of carrion for him not to turn away from it with a shudder. Wherever life is in the process of being made, germination and fermentation, it provokes disgust because it is being made only when it is being unmade. The viscous glandular embryo opens the cycle that ends in the rotting of death. Horrified by death's gratuitousness, man is horrified at having been engendered. He would like to rescind his animal attachments. Because of his birth, murderous nature has a grip on him. For the primitives, childbirth is surrounded by strict taboos. In particular, the placenta must be carefully burned or thrown into the sea, because whoever might get hold of it would hold the newborn's fate in his hands. This envelope in which the fetus is formed is the sign of its dependence. In annihilating it, the individual is able to detach himself from the living magma and to realize himself as an autonomous being. The stain of childbirth falls back on the mother. Leviticus and all the ancient codes impose purification rites on the new mother, and often in the countryside, the postpartum ceremony maintains that tradition. Everyone knows that young boys and girls and men feel a spontaneous embarrassment, one often camouflaged by sneering at seeing a pregnant woman's stomach or the swollen breasts of the wet nurse. In Dupuytren's museums, the curious contemplate the wax embryos and the preserved fetuses with the morbid interest they would show in a defiled grave. Notwithstanding all the respect that society surrounds it with, the function of gestation inspires spontaneous repulsion. And while the little boy in early childhood remains sensually attached to the mother's flesh, when he grows up, when he is socialized and becomes aware of his individual existence, this flesh frightens him. He wants to ignore it and to see his mother as institution only. If he wants to think of her as pure and chaste, it is less from amorous jealousy than from the refusal to acknowledge her as a body. An adolescent boy becomes embarrassed, blushes if he meets his mother, sisters, or women in his family when he is out with his friends. Their presence recalls the regions of imminence from which he wants to escape. She reveals the roots that he wants to pull himself away from. The boy's irritation when his mother kisses and caresses him has the same significance. He gives up his family, mother, and mother's breast. He would like to have emerged, like Athena, into the adult world, armed from head to toe, invulnerable. Note, refer to our study on Montholon, the epitome of this attitude, a little further on. Being conceived and born is the curse weighing on his destiny, the blemish on his being, and it is the warning of his death. The cult of germination has always been associated with the cult of the dead. Mother Earth engulfs the bones of its children within it. Women, the Parcae and Moirae, weave human destiny, but they also cut the threads. In most folk representations, death is woman, and women mourn the dead because death is their work. Note, Demeter is the archetype of the Mater Dolorosa, but other goddesses, Ishtar and Artemis, are cruel. Kali is holding a blood-filled skull. The heads of your newly killed sons hang from your neck like a necklace. Your figure is beautiful like rain clouds. Your feet are soiled with blood, says a Hindu poem. Thus, Mother Earth has a face of darkness. She is chaos, where everything comes from and must return to one day. She is nothingness. The many aspects of the world that the day uncovers commingle in the night. Night of spirit locked up in the generality and opacity of matter, night of sleep and nothing. At the heart of the sea, it is night. Woman is the mare tenebrarum, dreaded by ancient navigators. It is night in the bowels of the earth. Man is threatened with being engulfed in this night, the reverse of fertility, and it horrifies him. He aspires to the sky, to light, to sunny heights, to the pure and crystal clear cold of blue, and underfoot is a moist, hot, and dark gulf ready to swallow him. Many legends have the hero falling and forever lost in maternal darkness, a cave, an abyss, hell. But once again, ambivalence is at work here. While germination is always associated with death, death is also associated with fertility. Detested, death is like a new birth, and so it is blessed. The dead hero, like Osiris, is resurrected every springtime, and he is regenerated by a new birth. Man's supreme hope, says Jung, is that the dark waters of death become the waters of life, that death and its cold embrace are the mother's lap, just as the sea, while engulfing the sun, rebirths in the depths. Note: Metamorphoses of the Libido. The theme of the burial of the sun god within the sea and its dazzling reemergence is common to many mythologies. And man wants to live, but he also hopes for rest, sleep, for nothingness. He does not wish for immortality for himself, and thus he can learn to love death. Inorganic matter is the mother's breast, Nietzsche wrote. Being delivered from life means becoming real again, completing oneself. Anyone who understands that would consider returning to unfeeling dust as a holiday. Chaucer puts this prayer into the mouth of an old man who cannot die. Thus restless I my wretched way must make, and on the ground which is my mother's gate, I knock with my staff early, aye, and late, and cry, O my dear mother, let me in. Man wants to assert his individual existence and proudly rest on his essential difference, but he also wants to break the barriers of the self and commingle with water, earth, night, nothingness, with the whole. Woman, who condemns man to finitude, also enables him to surpass his own limits. That is where the equivocal magic surrounding her comes from. In all civilizations, and still today, she inspires horror in man, the horror of his own carnal contingents that he projects on her. The girl who has not yet gone through puberty does not pose a threat. She is not the object of any taboo and has no sacred characteristics. In many primitive societies, her sex even seems innocent. Erotic games between boys and girls are allowed in childhood. Woman becomes impure the day she might be able to procreate. In primitive societies, the strict taboos concerning girls on the day of their first period have often been described. Even in Egypt, where the woman is treated with particular respect, she remains confined during her whole menstrual period. Note: the difference between mystical and mythical beliefs and individuals' lived convictions is apparent in the following fact. Levi Strauss points out that young Winnebago Indians visit their mistresses and take advantage of the privacy of the prescribed isolation of these women during their menstrual period. She is often put on a rooftop or relegated to a shack on the outskirts of the town. She can be neither seen nor touched. What's more, she must not even touch herself with her own hand. For peoples that practice daily flea removal, she is given a stick with which she is able to scratch herself. She must not touch food with her fingers. Sometimes she is strictly forbidden to eat. In other cases, her mother and sister are permitted to feed her with an instrument, but all objects that come in contact with her during this period must be burned. After this first test, the menstrual taboos are a little less strict, but they remain harsh. In particular, in Leviticus, and if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her flesh be blood, she shall be put apart 7 days, and whosoever toucheth her shall be unclean until the even. And everything that she lieth upon in her separation shall be unclean. Everything also that she sitteth upon shall be unclean. And whosoever toucheth her bed shall wash his clothes, and bathe himself in water, and be unclean until the even. This text is perfectly symmetrical with one concerning gonorrhea-provoked impurity in man, and the purifying sacrifice is identical in the two cases. 7 days after she has been purified of her flow, two turtle doves or two young pigeons have to be brought to the sacrificer, who offers them to the Eternal. Even in matriarchal societies, the virtues connected to menstruation are ambivalent. On the one hand, it brings social activities to a halt, destroys the vital force, withers flowers, causes fruit to fall, but it also has beneficial effects. Menses are used in love filters, in remedies, and in particular, in healing cuts and bruises. Still today, when some Indians go off to fight spectral monsters haunting their rivers, they place a fiber wad filled with menstrual blood on the bow of their boat. Its emanations are harmful to their supernatural enemies. In some Greek cities, young girls pay homage to the temple of Astarte by wearing linens stained by their first menstrual blood. But since patriarchy, only harmful powers have been attributed to the bizarre liquor flowing from the feminine sex. Pliny, in his Natural History, says, "The menstruating woman spoils harvests, devastates gardens, kills seeds, makes fruit fall, kills bees. If she touches the wine, it turns to vinegar, milk sours." An old English poet expresses the same thought. "O menstruating woman, thou art a fiend, from whom all nature should be closely screened." These beliefs have been vigorously perpetuated right up to today. In 1878, a member of the British Medical Association wrote in the British Medical Journal, "It is an indisputable fact that meat goes bad when touched by menstruating women." He said that he personally knew of two cases of hams spoiling in such circumstances. In the refineries of the North at the beginning of this century, women were prohibited by law from going into the factory when they were afflicted by what the Anglo-Saxons call the curse, because the sugar turned black. And in Saigon, women are not employed in opium factories. Because of their periods, the opium goes bad and becomes bitter. These beliefs survive in many areas of the French countryside. Any cook knows how impossible it is to make mayonnaise if she is indisposed or simply in the presence of another woman who is indisposed. In Anjou recently, an old gardener who had stocked that year's cider harvest in the cellar wrote to the master of the house, "Don't let the young women of the household and their female guests go through the cellar on certain days of the month. They would prevent the cider from fermenting." When the cook heard about this letter, she shrugged her shoulders. "That never prevented cider from fermenting," she said. "It is only bad for bacon fat. It cannot be salted in the presence of an indisposed woman. It would rot." Note: a doctor from the Cher region pointed out to me that women in that situation are banned from going into the mushroom beds. The question as to whether there is any basis for these preconceived ideas is still discussed today. Dr. Binet's only fact supporting them is an observation by Schenck, cited by Vigna. Schenck supposedly saw flowers wilt in an indisposed servant's hands. Yeast cakes made by this woman supposedly rose only 3 centimeters instead of the 5 they usually rose. In any case, these facts are pretty feeble and poorly established when considering the importance and universality of the obviously mystical beliefs they come from. Putting this repulsion in the same category as that provoked by blood is most inadequate, more imbued with the mysterious mana that is both life and death than anything else. Blood, of course, is in itself a sacred element. But menstrual blood's baleful powers are more particular. Menstrual blood embodies the essence of femininity, which is why its flow endangers woman herself, whose mana is thus materialized. During the Chagas initiation rites, girls are urged to carefully conceal their menstrual blood. "Do not show it to your mother, for she would die. Do not show it to your age mates, for there may be a wicked one among them, who will take away the cloth with which you have cleaned yourself, and you will be barren in your marriage. Do not show it to a bad woman, who will take the cloth to place it in the top of her hut, with the result that you cannot bear children. Do not throw the cloth on the path or in the bush. A wicked person might do evil things with it. Bury it in the ground. Protect the blood from the gaze of your father, brothers, and sisters. It is a sin to let them see it. Note. Quoted in Levi-Strauss, The Elementary Structures of Kinship. For the Aleuts, if the father sees his daughter during her first menstruation, she could go blind or deaf. It is thought that during this period, woman is possessed by a spirit and invested with a dangerous power. Some primitives believe that the flow is provoked by snakebite, as woman has suspicious affinities with snakes and lizards. It is supposed to be similar to crawling animals' venom. Leviticus compares it to gonorrhea. The bleeding feminine sex is not only a wound, but a suspicious sore. And Vigny associates the notion of soiling with illness. Woman, sick child, and impure 12 times. The result of interior alchemic troubles, the periodic hemorrhage woman suffers from, is bizarrely aligned with the moon cycle. The moon also has dangerous whims. Note, the moon is a source of fertility. It is seen as the master of women. It is often believed that the moon, in the form of a man or a snake, couples with women. The snake is an epiphany of the moon. It molts and regenerates. It is immortal. It is a power that distributes fertility and science. It watches over holy sources, the tree of life, the fountain of youth, and so on. But it is also the snake that takes immortality away from man. It is said that it couples with women. Persian and rabbinical traditions claim that menstruation is due to the first woman's intercourse with the snake. Woman is part of the formidable workings that order the course of planets and the sun. She is prey to the cosmic forces that determine the destiny of stars and tides, while men are subjected to their worrisome radiation. But it is especially striking that menstrual blood's effects are linked to the ideas of cream going sour, mayonnaise that does not take, fermentation and decomposition. It is also claimed that it is apt to cause fragile objects to break, to spring violin and harp strings. But above all, it influences organic substances that are midway between matter and life. This is less because it is blood than because it emanates from genital organs. Even without knowing its exact function, people understood it to be linked to the germination of life. Ignorant of the existence of the ovary, the ancients saw in menstruation the complement of the sperm. In fact, it is not this blood that makes woman impure, but rather this blood is a manifestation of her impurity. It appears when the woman can be fertile. When it disappears, she becomes sterile again. It pours forth from this womb where the fetus is made. The horror of feminine fertility that man experiences is expressed through it. The strictest taboo of all concerning woman in her impure state is the prohibition of sexual intercourse with her. Leviticus condemns man to 7 days of impurity if he transgresses this rule. The laws of Manu are even harsher. The wisdom, energy, strength, and vitality of a man coming near a woman stained by menstrual excretions perish definitively. Priests ordered 50 days of penance for men who had sexual relations during menstruation. Since the feminine principle is then considered as reaching its highest power, it is feared that it would triumph over the male principle in intimate contact. Less specifically, man shies away from finding the mother's feared essence in the woman he possesses. He works at dissociating these two aspects of femininity. That explains why incest is prohibited by exogamy or more modern forms and is a universal law. That explains why man distances himself from woman sexually when she is particularly destined for her reproductive role, during her period, when she is pregnant, or when she is nursing. Not only does the Oedipus complex, whose description, incidentally, has to be revised, not contradict this attitude, on the contrary, it even implies it. Man guards himself against woman to the extent that she is the confused source of the world and disorder, become organic. However, this representation of woman also allows the society that has been separated from the cosmos and the gods to remain in communication with them. She still assures the fertility of the fields for the Bedouins and the Iroquois. In ancient Greece, she heard subterranean voices. She understood the language of the wind and the trees. She was the Pythia, Sibyl, and Prophetess. The dead and the gods spoke through her mouth. Still today, she has these powers of divination. She is medium, palmist, card reader, clairvoyant, inspired. She hears voices and has visions. When men feel the need to delve into vegetable and animal life, like Antaeus, who touched earth to recoup his strength, they call upon woman. Throughout the Greek and Roman rationalist civilizations, Thonian cults subsisted. They could usually be found on the periphery of official religious life. They even ended up, as in Eleusis, taking the form of mysteries. They had the opposite meaning of sun cults, where man asserted his will for separation and spirituality. But they complemented them. Man sought to overcome his solitude by ecstasy. That is the goal of mysteries, orgies, and bacchanals. In the world reconquered by males, the male god Dionysus usurped Ishtar's and Astarte's magic and wild virtues, but it was women who went wild over his image. The Maenads, Thyads, and Bacchants led men to religious drunkenness and sacred madness. The role of sacred prostitution is similar, both to unleash and to channel the powers of fertility. Even today, popular holidays are exemplified by outbreaks of eroticism. Woman is not just an object of pleasure, but a means of reaching this hubris in which the individual surpasses himself. What a being possesses in the deepest part of himself, what is lost and tragic, the blinding wonder, can no longer be found anywhere but on a bed, wrote Georges Bataille. In Sexual Release, man, in his lover's embrace, seeks to lose himself in the infinite mystery of the flesh. But it has already been seen that his normal sexuality, on the contrary, dissociates mother from wife. He finds the mysterious alchemies of life repugnant, while his own life is nourished and enchanted by the tasty fruits of the earth. He desires to appropriate them for himself. He covets Venus freshly emerging from the waters. Woman first discovers herself in patriarchy as wife, since the supreme creator is male. Before being the mother of humankind, Eve is Adam's companion. She was given to man for him to possess and fertilize, as he possesses and fertilizes the soil, and through her, he makes his kingdom out of all nature. Man does not merely seek in the sexual act subjective and ephemeral pleasure. He wants to conquer. Take and possess. To have a woman is to conquer her. He penetrates her as the plowshare in the furrows. He makes her his as he makes his the earth he is working. He plows, he plants, he sows. These images are as old as writing. From antiquity to today, 1,000 examples can be mentioned. Woman is like the field and man like the seeds, say the laws of Manu. In an André Masson drawing, there is a man, shovel in hand, tilling the garden of a feminine sex. Woman is her husband's prey, his property. Note, Rabelais called the male sex the worker of nature. The religious and historical origin of the phallus, plowshare, woman, furrow association has already been pointed out. Man's hesitation between fear and desire, between the terror of being possessed by uncontrollable forces and the will to overcome them, is grippingly reflected in the virginity myths. Dreaded or desired or even demanded by the male, virginity is the highest form of the feminine mystery. This aspect is simultaneously the most troubling and the most fascinating. Depending on whether man feels crushed by the powers encircling him or arrogantly believes he is able to make them his, he refuses or demands that his wife be delivered to him as a virgin. In the most primitive societies where woman's power is exalted, it is fear that dominates. Woman has to be deflowered the night before the wedding. Marco Polo asserted that for the Tibetans, none of them wanted to take a virgin girl as wife. A rational explanation has sometimes been given for this refusal. Man does not want a wife who has not yet aroused masculine desires. Al-Bakri, the Arab geographer, speaking of the Slavic peoples, notes that if a man gets married and finds that his wife is a virgin, he says, if you were worth something, men would have loved you, and one of them would have taken your virginity. He then chases her out and repudiates her. It is also claimed that some primitives refuse to marry a woman unless she has already given birth, thus proving her fertility. But the real reasons for the very widespread deflowering customs are mystical. Certain peoples imagine the presence of a serpent in the vagina that would bite the spouse during the breaking of the hymen. Terrifying virtues are given to virginal blood, linked to menstrual blood, and capable of ruining the male's vigor. These images express the idea that the feminine principle is so powerful and threatening because it is intact. Note, the power in combat attributed to the virgin comes from this, the Valkyries and Joan of Arc, for example. Sometimes the deflowering issue is not raised. For example, Malinowski describes an indigenous population in which, because sexual games are allowed from childhood on, girls are never virgins. Sometimes the mother, older sister, or some other matron systematically deflowers the girl, and throughout her childhood widens the vaginal opening. Deflowering can also be carried out by women during puberty using a stick, a bone, or a stone, and this is not considered a surgical operation. In other tribes, the girl at puberty is subjected to savage initiation rites. Men drag her out of the village and deflower her with instruments or by raping her. Giving over virgins to passers-by is one of the most common rites. Either these strangers are not thought to be sensitive to this manna, dangerous only for the tribe's males, or it does not matter what evils befall them. Even more often, the priest, medicine man, boss, or head of the tribe deflowers the fiancée the night before the wedding. On the Malabar coast, the Brahmins have to carry out this act, apparently without joy, for which they demand high wages. All holy objects are known to be dangerous for the outsider, but consecrated individuals can handle them without risk. That explains why priests and chiefs are able to tame the malefic forces against which the spouse has to protect himself. In Rome, all that was left of these customs was a symbolic ceremony. The fiancé was seated on a stone priapus phallus with the double aim of increasing her fertility and absorbing the overpowerful and therefore harmful fluids within her. The husband defends himself in yet another way. He himself deflowers the virgin, but during ceremonies that render him invulnerable at this critical juncture. For example, he does it in front of the whole village with a stick or bone. In Samoa, he uses his finger covered in a white cloth and distributes blood-stained shreds to the spectators. There is also the case of the man allowed to deflower his wife normally, but he has to wait 3 days to ejaculate in her, so that the generating seed is not soiled by hymen blood. In a classic reversal in the area of sacred things, virginal blood in less primitive societies is a propitious symbol. There are still villages in France where the bloody sheet is displayed to parents and friends the morning after the wedding. In the patriarchal regime, man becomes woman's master, and the same characteristics that are frightening in animals or untamed elements become precious qualities for the owner who knows how to subdue them. Man took the ardor of the wild horse and the violence of lightning and waterfalls as the instruments of his prosperity. Therefore, he wants to annex woman to him with all her riches intact. The order of virtue imposed on the girl certainly obeys rational motives. Like chastity for the wife, the fiancé's innocence is necessary to protect the father from incurring any risk of bequeathing his goods to a foreign child. But woman's virginity is demanded more imperiously when man considers the wife as his personal property. First of all, the idea of possession is always impossible to realize positively. The truth is that one never has anything or anyone. one attempts to accomplish it in a negative way. The surest way to assert that a good is mine is to prevent another from using it. And then, nothing seems as desirable to man as what has never belonged to any other human. Thus, conquest is a unique and absolute event. Virgin land has always fascinated explorers. Alpinists kill themselves every year attempting to assault an untouched mountain, or even trying to open up a new trail. And the curious risk their lives to descend underground to the bottom of unprobed caves. An object that men have already mastered has become a tool. Cut off from its natural bonds, it loses its deepest attributes. There is more promise in the wild water of torrents than in that of public fountains. A virgin body has the freshness of secret springs, the morning bloom of a closed corolla, the orient of the pearl the sun has never yet caressed, cave, temple, sanctuary, or secret garden. Like the child, man is fascinated by these shadowy and closed places, never yet touched by animating consciousness. Waiting to be lent a soul, it seems to him that he in fact created what he is the only one to grasp and penetrate. Moreover, every desire pursues the aim of consuming the desired object, entailing its destruction. By breaking the hymen, man possesses the feminine body more intimately than by a penetration that leaves it intact. In this irreversible operation, he unequivocally makes it a passive object, asserting his hold on it. This exactly expresses the meaning in the legend of the knight who hacks his way through thorny bushes to pick a rose never before inhaled. Not only does he uncover it, but he breaks its stem, thereby conquering it. The image is so clear that in popular language, taking a woman's flower means destroying her virginity, giving the origin of the word deflowering. But virginity only has this sexual attraction when allied with youth. Otherwise, its mystery reverts to disquiet. Many men today are sexually repulsed by older virgins. Psychological reasons alone do not explain why old maids are regarded as bitter and mean matrons. The curse is in their very flesh, this flesh that is object for no subject, that no desire has made desirable, that has bloomed and wilted without finding a place in the world of men. Turned away from her destination, the old maid becomes an eccentric object, as troubling as the incommunicable thinking of a madman. Of a 40-year-old, still beautiful woman presumed to be a virgin, I heard a man say with great vulgarity, "It's full of cobwebs in there." It is true that deserted and unused cellars and attics are full of unsavory mystery. They fill up with ghosts. Abandoned by humanity, houses become the dwellings of spirits. If feminine virginity has not been consecrated to a god, it is easily then thought to imply marriage with the devil. Virgins that men have not subjugated, old women who have escaped their power, are more easily looked upon as witches than other women. As woman's destiny is to be doomed to another, if she does not submit to a man's yoke, she is available for the devil's. Exercised by deflowering rites, or on the contrary, purified by her virginity, the wife could thus be desirable prey. Taking her gives the lover all the riches of life he desires to possess. She is all the fauna, all the earthly flora, gazelle, doe, lilies and roses, downy peaches, fragrant raspberries. She is precious stones, mother of pearl, agate, pearls, silk, the blue of the sky, the freshness of springs, air, flame, earth, and water. All the poets of East and West have metamorphosed woman's body into flowers, fruits, and birds. Here again, throughout antiquity, the Middle Ages, and the modern period, it would be necessary to quote a thick anthology. The Song of Songs is well known, in which the male loved one says to the female loved one, "Thou hast dove's eyes. Thy hair is as a flock of goats. Thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins. Honey and milk are under thy tongue." In Arcanum 17, André Breton took up this eternal song. Melusina, at the instant of her second scream, she sprang up off her globeless haunches. Her belly is the whole August harvest. Her torso bursts into fireworks from her arched back. Modeled on a swallow's two wings, her breasts are two ermines caught in their own scream, blinding because they are lit by scorching coals of their howling mouth. And her arms are the soul of streams that sing and float perfumes. Man finds shining stars and the moody moon, sunlight and the darkness of caves on woman. Wildflowers from hedgerows and the garden's proud rose are also woman. Nymphs, dryads, mermaids, water sprites, and fairies haunt the countryside, the woods, lakes, seas, and moors. This animism is profoundly anchored in men. For the sailor, the sea is a dangerous woman, perfidious and difficult to conquer, but that he cherishes by dint of taming it. Proud, rebellious, virginal, and wicked, the mountain is woman for the mountain climber who wants to take it, even at risk of life. It is often said that these comparisons manifest sexual sublimation. Rather, they express an affinity between woman and the elements as primal as sexuality itself. Man expects more from possessing woman than the satisfaction of an instinct. She is the special object through which he subjugates nature. Other objects can also play this role. Sometimes it is on young boys' bodies that man seeks the sand of beaches, the velvet of nights, the fragrance of honeysuckle. But sexual penetration is not the only way to realize this carnal appropriation of the earth. In his novel, To a God Unknown, Steinbeck shows a man who chooses a mossy rock as mediator between him and nature. In The Cat, Colette describes a young husband who settles his love on his favorite female cat because this gentle wild animal enables him to have a grasp on the sensual universe that his woman companion cannot give. The other can be embodied in the sea and the mountain just as well as in the woman. They provide man with the same passive and unexpected resistance that allows him to accomplish himself. They are a refusal to conquer, a prey to possess. If the sea and the mountain are woman, it is because woman is also the sea and the mountain for the lover. Note, the sentence by Samivel, quoted by Bachelard in Earth and Reveries of Will, is telling. I had ceased, little by little, to regard the mountains crouching in a circle at my feet as foes to vanquish, as females to trample underfoot, or trophies to provide myself and others proof of my own worth. The mountain-woman ambivalence comes across in the common idea of foes to vanquish, trophies, and proof of my own worth. This reciprocity can be seen, for example, in these two poems by Senghor. Naked woman, dark woman, ripe fruit with firm flesh, dark raptures of black wine, mouth that gives music to my mouth, savanna of clear horizons, savanna quivering to the fervent caress of the east wind. And, Oho, Congo lying on your bed of forests, queen of subdued Africa. May the mountain phalluses hold high your pavilion, for you are woman by my head, by my tongue. You are woman by my belly. But not just any woman can play the role of mediator between man and the world. Man is not satisfied with finding sexual organs complementary to his own in his partner. She must embody the wondrous blossoming of life while concealing its mysterious disturbances at the same time. First of all, she has to have youth and health, for man cannot be enraptured in his embrace of a living thing unless he forgets that all life is inhabited by death. And he desires still more, that his beloved be beautiful. The ideal of feminine beauty is variable, but some requirements remain constant. One of them is that since woman is destined to be possessed, her body has to provide the inert and passive qualities of an object. Virile beauty is the body's adaptation to active functions such as strength, agility, flexibility, and the manifestation of a transcendence animating a flesh that must never collapse into itself. The only symmetry to be found in the feminine ideal is in Sparta, fascist Italy, and Nazi Germany, societies that destined woman for the state and not for the individual, and that considered her exclusively as mother, with no place for eroticism. But when woman is delivered to the male as his property, he claims that her flesh be presented in its pure facticity. Her body is grasped not as the emanation of a subjectivity, but as a thing weighted in its eminence. This body must not radiate to the rest of the world. It must not promise anything but itself. Its desire has to be stopped. The most naive form of this requirement is the Hottentot ideal of the Steatopygus Venus, as the buttocks are the part of the body with the fewest nerve endings, where the flesh appears as a given without purpose. The taste of people from the East for fleshy women is similar. They love the absurd luxury of this fatty proliferation that is not enlivened by any project, that has no other meaning than to be there. Note, Hottentot women, in whom steatopygia is neither as developed nor as consistent as in Bushmen women, think this body type is aesthetically pleasing and, starting in childhood, massage their daughters' buttocks to develop them. Likewise, the artificial fattening of women, a real stuffing by two means, immobility and abundant ingestion of specific foods, especially milk, is found in various regions of Africa. It is still practiced by rich Arab and Jewish city dwellers in Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. Luquet, Venus des Cavernes, Journal de Psychologie, 1934. Even in civilizations of a more subtle sensibility, where notions of form and harmony come into play, breasts and buttocks were prized objects because of the gratuitousness and contingency of their development. Customs and fashions were often applied to cut the feminine body from its transcendence. The Chinese woman with bound feet could barely walk. The Hollywood star's painted nails deprived her of her hands. High heels, corsets, hoops, farthingales, and crinolines were meant less to accentuate the woman's body's curves than to increase the body's powerlessness. Weighted down by fat, or on the contrary, so diaphanous that any effort is forbidden to it, paralyzed by uncomfortable clothes and rites of propriety, the body thus appeared to man as his thing. Makeup and jewels were also used for this petrification of the body and face. The function of dress and ornaments is highly complex. For some primitives, it had a sacred character, but its most usual role was to complete woman's metamorphosis into an idol. An equivocal idol, man wanted her erotic, for her beauty to be part of that of flowers and fruits, but she also had to be smooth, hard, eternal, like a stone. The role of dress is both to link the body more closely to and to wrest it away from nature, to give a necessarily set artifice to palpitating life. Woman was turned into plant, panther, diamond, or mother of pearl by mingling flowers, furs, precious stones, shells, and feathers on her body. She perfumed herself so as to smell of roses and lilies, but feathers, silk, pearls, and perfumes also worked to hide the animal rawness from its flesh and odor. She painted her mouth and her cheeks to acquire a mask's immobile solidity. Her gaze was imprisoned in the thickness of kohl and mascara. It was no longer anything but her eyes' shimmering ornamentation. Braided, curled, or sculpted, her hair lost its troublesome vegetal mystery. In the embellished woman, nature was present but captive, shaped by a human will in accordance with man's desire. Woman was even more desirable when nature was shown off to full advantage and more rigorously subjugated. The sophisticated woman has always been the ideal erotic object, and the taste for a more natural beauty is often a specious form of sophistication. Rémy de Gourmont wanted women's hair to be loose, free as the streams and prairie grass. But it is on Veronica Lake's hair that the waves of water and wheat could be caressed, not on a mop of hair totally left to nature. The younger and healthier a woman is, and the more her new and glossy body seems destined for eternal freshness, the less useful is artifice. But the carnal weakness of this prey that man takes and its ominous deterioration always have to be hidden from him. It is also because he fears contingent destiny, because he dreams her immutable and necessary, that man looks for the idea's exactitude on woman's face, body, and legs. In primitive people, this idea is the perfection of the popular type, a thick-lipped race with a flat nose forged a thick-lipped Venus with a flat nose. Later, the canons of a more complex aesthetics would be applied to women. But in any case, the more the traits and proportions of a woman seemed contrived, the more she delighted the heart of man, because she seemed to escape the metamorphosis of natural things. The result is this strange paradox that by desiring to grasp nature, but transfigured, in woman, man destines her to artifice. She is not only physis, but just as much antiphysis, and not only in the civilization of electric permanence, hair waxing, latex girdles, but also in the country of African lip disc women, in China, and everywhere on earth. Swift denounced this mystification in his famous ode to Celia. He railed against the coquette's paraphernalia, pointing out with disgust her body's animal servitudes. He was doubly wrong to become indignant, because man wants woman at the same time to be animal and plant, and that she hide behind a fabricated armature. He loves her emerging from the waves and from a high fashion house, naked and dressed, naked beneath her clothes, exactly as he finds her in the human universe. The city dweller seeks animality in woman, but for the young peasant doing his military service, the brothel embodies the magic of the city. Woman is field and pasture, but also Babylonia. However, here is the first lie, the first betrayal of woman, of life itself, which, even clothed in the most attractive forms, is still inhabited by the ferments of old age and death. The very use man makes of her destroys her most precious qualities. Weighed down by childbirth, she loses her sexual attraction. Even sterile, the passage of time is enough to alter her charms. Disabled, ugly, or old, woman repels. She is said to be withered, faded like a plant. Man's decrepitude is obviously also frightful, but normal man does not experience other men as flesh. He has only an abstract solidarity with these autonomous and foreign bodies. It is on woman's body, this body meant for him, that man significantly feels the flesh's deterioration. It is through the male's hostile eyes that Villon's once beautiful courtesan contemplates her body's degradation. Old and ugly women not only are objects without assets, but also provoke hatred mixed with fear. They embody the disturbing figure of mother, while the charms of the wife have faded away. But even the wife was a dangerous prey. Demeter survives in Venus, emerging from the waters, fresh foam, the blonde harvest, appropriating woman for himself through the pleasure he derives from her. Man awakens in her the suspicious powers of fertility. It is the same organ he penetrates that produces the child. This explains why man in all societies is protected against the feminine sex's threats by so many taboos. There is no reciprocity as woman has nothing to fear from the male. His sex is considered secular, profane. The phallus can be raised to the dignity of a god. There is no element of terror in worshipping it, and in daily life, woman does not have to be defended against it mystically. It is simply propitious for her. It also has to be pointed out that in many matriarchies, sexuality is very free, but this is only during woman's childhood, in her early youth, when coitus is not linked to the idea of generation. Malinowski is surprised that young people who sleep together freely in the house of the unmarried show off their love lives so readily. The explanation is that an unmarried daughter is considered unable to bear a child, and the sexual act is merely a quiet and ordinary pleasure. On the contrary, once married, her spouse cannot give her any public sign of affection, nor touch her, and any allusion to their intimate relations is sacrilegious. She then has to be part of the formidable essence of mother, and coitus becomes a sacred act. From then on, it is surrounded by taboos and precautions. Intercourse is forbidden when cultivating the earth, sowing, and planting. In this case, fertilizing forces necessary for the harvest's prosperity cannot be wasted in inter-individual relations. Respect for powers associated with fertility enjoins such relations to be economized. But on most occasions, chastity protects the spouse's virility. It is demanded when man goes off fishing or hunting, and above all when he is preparing for war. In the union with woman, the male principle weakens, and he has to avoid intercourse whenever he needs the totality of his forces. It has been wondered if the horror man feels for woman comes from that inspired by sexuality in general, or vice versa. We have seen that in Leviticus in particular, wet dreams are considered a stain, even though woman has nothing to do with them. And in our modern societies, masturbation is considered a danger and a sin. Many children and young boys who indulge in it suffer terrible anxieties because of it. Society and parents, above all, make solitary pleasure a vice. But more than one young boy has been spontaneously frightened by his first ejaculations. Blood or sperm, any flow of one's own substance, seems worrying. It is one's life, one's manna, that is running out. However, even if subjectively man can go through erotic experiences where woman is not present, she is objectively involved in his sexuality. As Plato said in The Myth of the Androgynes, the male organism presupposes the woman's. He discovers woman in discovering his own sex, even if she is not given to him in flesh and blood, nor in image, and inversely, woman is fearsome inasmuch as she embodies sexuality. The immanent and transcendent aspects of living experience can never be separated. What I fear or desire is always an avatar of my own existence, but nothing comes to me except through what is not myself. The non-self is involved in wet dreams, in erection, and if not in the precise figure of woman, at least in nature and life. The individual feels possessed by a foreign magic. Likewise, his ambivalence toward women is seen in his attitude toward his own sex organ. He is proud. He laughs about it. He is embarrassed by it. The little boy defiantly compares his penis with his friend's. His first erection fills him with pride and frightens him at the same time. The adult man looks upon his sex organ as a symbol of transcendence and power. He is as proud of it as a muscle, and at the same time as a magical grace. It is a freedom rich with the whole contingence of the given, a given freely desired. This is the contradictory aspect that enchants him, but he suspects the trap in it. This sex organ by which he claims to assert himself does not obey him. Full of unassuaged desires, arising unexpectedly, sometimes relieving itself in dreams, it manifests a suspicious and capricious vitality. Man claims to make spirit triumph over life, activity over passivity. His consciousness keeps nature at a distance. His will shapes it. But in the figure of his sex organ, he rediscovers life, nature, and passivity in himself. The sexual parts are the real center of the will, and the opposite pole is the brain, wrote Schopenhauer. What he called will is attachment to life, which is suffering and death, while the brain is thought that separates itself from life while representing it. Sexual shame, according to him, is what we feel about our stupid carnal stubbornness. Even if the pessimism of his theories is rejected, he is right to see the expression of man's duality in the sex-brain opposition. As a subject, he posits the world, and remaining outside the universe, he posits, he makes himself the lord of it. If he grasps himself as flesh, as sex, he is no longer autonomous consciousness, transparent freedom. He is engaged in the world, a limited and perishable object, and it is undoubtedly true that the generative act goes beyond the body's limits, but he constitutes them at the very same instant. The penis, father of generations, is symmetrical to the maternal womb, grown from a fattened germ in woman's womb. Man is the bearer of germs himself, and by this seed that gives life, it is also his own life that is disavowed. The birth of children is the death of parents, said Hegel. Ejaculation is the promise of death. It affirms the species over the individual. the existence of the sex organ and its activity negate the subject's proud singularity. The sex organ is a focus of scandal because of this contestation of spirit over life. Man exalts the phallus in that he grasps it as transcendence and activity, as a means of appropriation of the other, but he is ashamed when he sees it in only passive flesh through which he is the plaything of life's obscure forces. This shame is often disguised as irony. The sex organ of others draws laughter easily, but because the erection looks like a planned movement and yet is undergone, it often looks ridiculous, and the simple mention of genital organs provokes glee. Malinowski says that for the wild people among whom he lived, just mentioning the word for these shameful parts made them laugh uncontrollably. Many crude or saucy jokes are not much more than rudimentary puns on these words. For some primitive peoples, during the days devoted to weeding out gardens, women had the right to brutally rape any stranger that dared to come into the village. Attacking him altogether, they often left him half dead. The tribesmen laughed at this exploit. By this rape, the victim was constituted as passive and dependent flesh. He was possessed by the women, and through them by their husbands, while in normal coitus, man wants to affirm himself as possessor. But this is where he will experience the ambiguity of his carnal condition most obviously. He takes pride in his sexuality only to the extent that it is a means of appropriation of the other. And this dream of possession only ends in failure. In authentic possession, the other, as such, is abolished. It is consumed and destroyed. Only the Sultan of the 1001 Nights has the power to cut off his mistress's heads when dawn withdraws them from his bed. Woman survives man's embraces, and she is thus able to escape from him. As soon as he opens his arms, his prey once again becomes foreign to him. Here she is new, intact, completely ready to be possessed by a new lover in just as ephemeral a way. One of the male's dreams is to brand woman so that she remains his forever. But even the most arrogant male knows only too well that he will never leave her anything more than memories, and the most passionate images are cold compared with real sensation. A whole literature has denounced this failure. It is made objective in the woman, who is called fickle and treacherous because her body destines her to man in general, and not to a particular man. Her betrayal is even more perfidious. It is she who turns the lover into a prey. Only a body can touch another body. The male masters the desired flesh only by becoming flesh himself. Eve is given to Adam for him to accomplish his transcendence in her, and she draws him into the night of imminence. The mother forges the obscure wrapping for her son, from which he now wants to escape, while the mistress encloses him in this opaque clay through the vertigo of pleasure. He wanted to possess, but here he is, possessed himself. Odor, damp, fatigue, boredom. A whole literature describes this dreary passion of consciousness become flesh. Desire often contains an element of disgust, and returns to disgust when it is assuaged. Post coitum homo animal triste. Note, most likely, post coitum homo animal triste. All animals are sad after sex. Translation. The flesh is sad. And yet man has not even found definitive reassurance in his lover's arms. Soon his desire is reborn, and often it is the desire not only for woman in general, but for this specific woman. She wields a singularly troubling power. Because in his own body, man does not feel the sexual need except as a general one similar to hunger or thirst without a particular object, the bond that links him to this specific feminine body is forged by the other. The link is mysterious, like the foul and fertile womb of his roots, a sort of passive force. It is magic. The hackneyed vocabulary of serialized novels, where the woman is described as an enchantress or a mermaid who fascinates man and bewitches him, reflects the oldest and most universal of myths. Woman is devoted to magic. Magic, said Alain, is the spirit lurking in things, and action is magic when it emanates from a passivity instead of being produced by an agent. Men have always considered woman precisely as the immanence of the given. If she produces harvests and children, it is not because she wills it. She is not subject, transcendence, or creative power, but an object charged with fluids. In societies where man worships such mysteries, woman, because of these qualities, is associated with religion and venerated as a priestess. But when he struggles to make society triumph over nature, reason over life, will over inert fact, woman is regarded as a sorceress. The difference between the priest and the magician is well known. The former dominates and directs the forces he has mastered in keeping with the gods and laws, for the good of the community, on behalf of all its members. While the magician operates outside society, against the gods and laws, according to his own passions. But woman is not fully integrated into the world of men. As other, she counters them. It is natural for her to use the strengths she possesses, not to spread the hold of transcendence across the community of men and into the future, but, being separate and opposed, to draw males into the solitude of separation, into the darkness of imminence. She is the mermaid whose songs dashed the sailors against the rocks. She is Circe, who turned her lovers into animals, the water sprite that attracted the fishermen to the depths of the pools. The man, captivated by her spell, loses his will, his project, his future. He is no longer a citizen, but flesh, slave to his desires. He is crossed out of the community, enclosed in the instant, thrown passively from torture to pleasure. The perverse magician pits passion against duty, the present against the unity of time. She keeps the traveler far from home. She spreads forgetfulness. In attempting to appropriate the other, man must remain himself. But with the failure of impossible possession, he tries to become this other with whom he fails to unite. So he alienates himself. He loses himself. He drinks the potion that turns him into a stranger to himself. He falls to the bottom of deadly and roiling waters. The mother dooms her son to death in giving him life. The woman lover draws her lover into relinquishing life and giving himself up to the supreme sleep. This link between love and death was pathetically illuminated in the Tristan legend, but it has a more primary truth. Born of flesh, man accomplishes himself in love as flesh, and flesh is destined to the grave. The alliance between woman and death is thus confirmed. The Great Reaper is the inverted figure of corn-growing fertility, but it is also the frightening wife whose skeleton appears under deceitful and tender flesh. Note, for example, in Prévert's ballet Le Rendez-vous and in Cocteau's Le Jeune Homme et l'Amour, The Young Man and Death, death is represented as a beloved young girl. What man thus cherishes and detests first in woman, lover as well as mother, is the fixed image of her animal destiny, the life essential to her existence, but that condemns her to finitude and death. From the day of birth, man begins to die. This is the truth that the mother embodies. In procreating, he guarantees the species against himself. This is what he learns in his wife's arms. In arousal and in pleasure, even before engendering, he forgets his singular self. Should he try to differentiate them, he still finds in both one fact alone, that of his carnal condition. He wants to accomplish it. He venerates his mother. He desires his mistress. But at the same time, he rebels against them in disgust, in fear. An important text where we will find a synthesis of almost all these myths is Jean-Richard Bloch's La Nuit Kurde, A Night in Kurdistan, in which he describes young Saad's embraces of a much older but still beautiful woman during the plundering of a city. The night abolished the contours of things and feelings alike. He was no longer clasping a woman to him. He was at last nearing the end of an interminable voyage that had been pursued since the beginning of the world. Little by little he dissolved into an immensity that cradled him round without shape or end. all women were confused into one giant land, folded upon him, suave as desire burning in summer. He, meanwhile, recognized with a fearful admiration the power that is enclosed within woman, the long-stretched satin thighs, the knees like two ivory hills. When he traced the polished arch of the back, from the waist to the shoulders, he seemed to be feeling the vault that supports the world. But the belly ceaselessly drew him, a tender and elastic ocean, whence all life is born, and whither it returns, asylum of asylums, with its tides, horizons, illimitable surfaces. Then he was seized with a rage to pierce that delightful envelope, and at last win to the very source of all this beauty. A simultaneous urge wrapped them one within the other. The woman now only lived to be cleaved by the share, to open to him her vitals, to gorge herself with the humors of the beloved. Their ecstasy was murderous. They came together as if with stabbing daggers. He, man, the isolated, the separated, the cut off, was going to gush forth from out of his own substance. He, the first, would come forth from his fleshly prison and at last go free, matter and soul into the universal matrix. To him was reserved the unheard-of happiness of overpassing the limits of the creature, of dissolving into the one exaltation, object and subject, question and answer, of annexing to being all that is not being, and of embracing in an unextinguishable river the empire of the unattainable. But each coming and going of the bow awoke in the precious instrument it held at its mercy, vibrations more and more piercing. Suddenly, a last spasm unloosed him from the zenith and cast him down again to earth, to the mire. As the woman's desire is not quenched,